Just a few weeks ago, I had the unique pleasure of introducing you to the new interim president of Interfaith Alliance, Reverend Dr. Catherine Rhodes Henderson. Unique in part because I myself am very happy to have just retired from the position of president at the Alliance after 7.5 deeply satisfying years. And now it gets even more unique because today I get to welcome to our program the person set to take that chair in September on a permanent basis. So you've got the President Emeritus of Interfaith Alliance interviewing the soon-to-be President and CEO of Interfaith Alliance, the Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. Paul, congratulations, and thanks a lot for being with us today.
It is such an honor to talk with you, and it is really an honor to be taking over the reins from you and to be serving this organization that I have admired for almost 30 years, and now to be a part of it and to be leading the group, the Alliance. I'm just couldn't be more proud, honored, and excited for the work ahead.
Wonderful, wonderful. Listen, a top challenge in recent years has been the outrageous way the term religious freedom has been perverted by the political religious right. So I'd love to start by asking you, what does religious freedom mean to you?
Religious freedom means that every individual is endowed with the ability to make moral and choices about their life and to follow whatever dictates that they follow from a religious tradition, a philosophical tradition, that people have the ability and the right to follow their conscience. However, the question is that none of this is done in isolation. So where the rubber hits the road with religious freedom is, how can my religious freedom not be your religious oppression? How can I be a way of offering my religious freedom as a blessing or as an opportunity for us to live together, even recognizing that what I view as important is not what you view as important? Because religious freedom never happens in isolation. And so that, I think, is the most important thing, is that we have to really understand religious freedom as it was intended. It was to protect the people who were the most vulnerable and not necessarily be a bludgeon for those who already have power. And so I am committed to those, all of those who would like to exercise their religious freedom, even if that means not following the dictates of others. And so we want, you know, I just think, unfortunately, religious freedom too often is perceived and exercised as a way to exercise bigotry. It's important to kind of take back what religious freedom means, because it's a very important idea and a principle of America, which is religious diversity and every religion being able to exercise freely in community. And that, I think, is the important part of it.
So you use the word vulnerable in your answer, and that's an important concept, because it seems that many Americans have been vulnerable to losing this precious but simple concept because of the relentless messaging from right-wing culture warriors. How do we address that?
I think actually I like to remember that the Interfaith Alliance was founded in a moment when people were throwing around terms like moral majority. And I really actually think that people who understand religious freedom the way you and I do and Interfaith Alliance understands it are in the majority, that people want people to be able to exercise religious freedom, but they do not want it to be used as part of the culture wars. They want it to be actually the freedom for everyone to follow the dictates of their faith and their conscience. So I think, you know, we need to... I'm very interested in going back on the offensive and saying, like, no, the way you're describing this is actually not, it does not provide the protection for the people who are most vulnerable when it comes to having religion sometimes being used as an excuse to exclude or to discriminate against. And there's, you know, this is not kind of some sort of fantasy. This has actually been documented over the history of our country, that people have used religion, unfortunately, in very terrible ways, whether that's in support of slavery or against interracial marriage, certainly against marriage equality when it comes to same-sex marriage. Now we see it with reproductive justice. And so we just have to remind people that people cannot understand religious freedom, what religion says to them in very different ways, but no one gets to say what is ultimately the truth to others.
What do you say to people who suggest that though they are in the majority or though they are in the plurality, their religious freedom is truncated by the claims of what you and I would agree are more vulnerable populations?
I think it's just, I think it's just a very dangerous road to go down. We've already exercised it. Like the idea that I can, that, you know, I think the most classic case that comes to mind for me is like the wedding cake. And the question is, you know, do we really want to live in a country where people can pick and choose who they serve? If they're open for business, they're open for business. And then, it, you know, what's, the, you just, you, there's no way that you can have a society where people are picking and choosing who they can serve based on their, if they're open for business, then they have to be open to, for business for everyone. Otherwise, we go back to moments where people can choose who to serve based on other distinctions. So I think I wrote a piece called The Fraying of America, Sincerely Held Beliefs and the Fraying of America, which really meant like, I'm worried that as we, you know, cling to our sincerely held beliefs, which allow us not to be engaging with people who are different from us, that the cohesion of our country is at risk. And the sense of ourselves as, you know, a people who want to be living with one another in society is at risk. And so I really hope that people will find a way. You don't have to agree with me on marriage equality. But I, you really don't like, and in your own circle, it's fine. But I really feel like I should have the same rights as other citizens when I go into a store or other kinds of things. And that's where I think where the rubber hits the road. And my hope is that people will understand that they can hold on to their beliefs. We all work with people who we disagree with all the time, and that's fine. But I do think like what we really, you know, what we really don't want is this kind of complete breaking apart and not interacting with people who are different from us. And that's the pluralism. It's the diversity that we want to celebrate and coming together across difference in ways that we can.
So we've seen a lot of ongoing revelations about how pervasive and the political religious rights access has been to our nation's leaders. By your view, should the progressive side be doing more of that, or would that just make things worse?
I don't think what I do believe is that some of the people we admire the most were motivated by their faith or their spirituality. We admire King, we admire Heschel, we admire Gandhi, and we admire them not in spite of their religion, but because of their religion and how strong it made them in their work. And you know, I don't want to start wielding religion as like, you know, the conversation ender. But I think it's actually fine for us to say, you know, no one has a monopoly on religion. No one has a like the market cornered. And so my guess is that there are many, many progressives out there who are working from place of faith. We know many of their names, both in politics and outside of politics. We should celebrate them. We should work together. But also recognize that the strongest coalitions will be people who are motivated by a faith tradition that is particular, but who are also able to work with people who are motivated by ones very different, who may not have any faith commitment per se, but have a deep moral or secular humanist faith commitment. So I don't think anybody should, to use a Christian phrase or a Jesus phrase, is like hide their light under a bushel. But that light can come in many different forms. And my hope is that it can all be a source of illumination for the whole.
So should you and I be praying with Justice Sotomayor?
I think if Justice Sotomayor asked me to pray with her, I would say, great, let's do it. I'm not going to ask her to compartmentalize her life. But I'm not going to give her the mantle of my religion and say, run with it, or any political figure. Like now you are the representative that we have waited for. I mean, there was all this garbage with like Obama, where everybody's like, oh, the left think he's an anointed one. None of us thought he was the anointed one. We thought he was a decent character who was good at politics and maybe could put, you know. On the other hand, when Trump came along, it's like, oh my God, God has chosen our president. And that's crazy to me, because what do you say to that? I mean, it's very hard. And it creates a sort of a very, very dangerous combination that leads to a theocracy that we just absolutely have to be working against right now. This idea of like kind of a Christian nationalist, and just to put it out there, a white Christian nationalist understanding of what government is, that precludes any other legitimate, that if once you go down that path, then anything that's not that is a threat. And it's just the most un-American idea I can imagine.
You know, Interfaith Alliance actually has a history with people in positions of power and the power of prayer. When President Bill Clinton was having his difficulties, shall we say, one of the pastors who ministered to him was his pastor, Phil Wagaman from United Methodist Church's Foundry UMC. And Phil was chair of the board of Interfaith Alliance at the time. I was always impressed that he never talked about that publicly. And he was there to tend to the president's soul, not to try to change his policies or any such things. So you're going to be in good company going forward. You spent a lot of time building up religious literacy in the form of HuffPo Religion, as well as at BeliefNet. Are we paying the price for projects like that getting less support in recent years than you or I would have liked to see them get?
First of all, thank you for that shout out to those that work that I was a part of. I just found that what was so important about that work was the recognition that there were such a diversity of religious voices and secular humanist voices and atheist voices, all of whom had, really wanted to be together and wanted to talk about what was important to them. And it was a great honor at that time to kind of lift up those voices, give them a very big platform that they hadn't otherwise had, and to recognize, wow, all these, if you looked at the page, you're like, oh, I can see all of these things in one place, and how wonderful that is. My hope is in this moment, which feels like a very critical kind of crossroads moment for America, that there will be a great deal of support from philanthropists and from other civic organizations to recognize that religious literacy and understanding the religious diversity of our country and how that's a foundational American value. That will to offset what we feel is like kind of creeping Christian nationalism. I think that, or it may not be creeping, it's galloping at this point. So I feel like we are, I think there's an opportunity, and I'm very eager to be looking for allies and support in this moment for the work of Interfaith Alliance going forward and making sure that people really remember, oh, this is great. It's great that we have a religiously diverse country. It's great that we have a pluralistic country where people can believe different things and still get along. What a wonderful thing, but it needs support. It needs like specific support. And that's what I'm looking forward to those conversations on about how we can get support going into the future.
Well, let's talk about one segment of our country whose support is very necessary for this. You've spent a lot of time working with youth-facing organizations, and most recently with what is now Interfaith America. It used to be Interfaith Youth Corps. How do you see young people engaging with these ideas?
I think, you know, I also worked at Princeton for 8 years with as the associate dean of the chapel, working on interfaith issues and kind of responsible for interfaith issues at the university. And I have to say, like, it gives me hope. I know that, like, oh, young people, you know, like, it's easier to go there, but actually young people are so, they really want to do the right thing. They really want to understand what my goal is always with youth is to give them the tools that they need to do the work that they want to do. And not all of it is just something you're born with and, you know, oh, you know, do the thing. I think that young people really believe in a diverse country. They see it around them. They grow up, I think, with much more diversity than we might have, you know, when you and I were younger. So what they're looking for is like, so how does this all fit? How do we build a country with this in mind? Whether that's, you know, racial diversity, religious diversity, gender and sexuality diversity, and how do we build a life together that benefits everybody, that lifts everybody up? And that's the goal. I think, you know, for me as a religious leader, that feels like the goal is like, how do we live together? How do we love one another? How do we respect one another? Young people really want to do that. That was always my sense. And the opportunity here is for people involved in the work of the alliances to reach out and say, this is the work we're doing. These are the tools that we can offer you to do that wherever you go. And we can support you in whatever you're doing. And that is a winning proposition. It's what I've seen.
So I remember when I took this job, how excited I was to be there. But I had been in the pulpit for many years and decided to start a new chapter of my life. Why, Paul, did you decide to take up this position that you'll assume officially in September?
Honestly, I'm still in it for another 2 weeks. I have a great job. I love my work. I've been able to do a lot of work at the intersection of faith and technology and interfaith and technology. And I have a really good job. Everything that I've done in my work with, the interfaith movement and my work in advocacy and my sincere, deep belief in religious freedom and this moment in our country where we need to protect democracy, all of it kind of comes together in this position. I feel like everything that I have learned about, you know, how to build coalitions, how to have conversations and messaging that works. All of it feels like I've been building towards this moment. And I'm just really excited for this opportunity. I also feel like this moment requires that many of us who were comfortable become slightly uncomfortable and step into new areas of work that this moment requires. We're going into a period where we need in like 5 years to look back and say that was the moment we met the challenge. We have sincere challenges ahead of us. And I felt like this is a moment where I want to meet the challenge head on with an organization and a team that I believe in, and a message that feels necessary for this country, but also completely enmeshed with what I believe is my calling as a religious leader. So I am, you know, it was not done lightly, but it felt like a calling. I'll use that language. And it felt like necessary for me to fulfill my obligations as a citizen.
So tell me what specifically a couple of those challenges are that are facing you at Interfaith Alliance, that have faced you at Interfaith America.
I think we've touched on one of them, which is, I think, this really disturbing confluence, almost meshing of a nationalism, and a Christian nationalism and a kind of race-based Christian nationalism that feels antithetical to the America that I know, and feels like we need to, those of us who believe in a country where everyone is respected, that at its founding recognized that religious diversity was an asset, and that religious freedom meant those that everyone could exercise their ability to follow their conscience as they will. So I feel like all of that is very threatening. I think the last couple of weeks of the Supreme Court were really horrifying. Some may know, but my great-grandfather is Louis Brandeis, who was really kind of instrumental in promoting the idea that privacy was a value, it was an American value, and wrote something called The Right to Privacy before he was in the court. And then when he was on the court, that became very important. And we are seeing the right to privacy, the right to for people to have the ability to make choices about their life under threat. And we're seeing a lot of it that coming under the guise of religion, a religion that is dictating one point of view to everyone else. And I find that deeply disturbing. I come from a proud family. My mother was very involved with reproductive justice, as were my sisters. And so I've taken my cue from the women in my life and really believe that there is a right to reproductive choice, reproductive justice. So I think that all of those point to a broader vision, which is, you know, I feel like there is a right now a bit of despondency among many sectors of America, not just the progressive. I think, you know, more conservative. There's just a lot of people who are just like wondering, like, is the American project completely failed? And, you know, I'm not a nationalist, but I do have a certain kind of patriotism that believes in the promise of America that is still becoming, that we are trying to achieve, as Baldwin said. And I feel like this moment, those of us who really believe in America and the promise of America that is yet to be fulfilled, but still is possible, that's what I feel like that's under threat, and I'm willing to stand for it and fight for it.
It's a wonderful broad vision. I want to get to a very narrow vision too. Because I have to ask you, you are the parent of two kids, a successful ordained public figure, married to a man. And I am a Jewish faith leader, married to a woman with three proudly Jewish families that we've sired, and including two grandchildren. We sit here today as members of two groups that face escalating hostility and violence. Where do you think our culture is going, influenced disproportionately by an extremist theocratic cabal that seems to have infiltrated all levels of our government and society? What do you worry about most for your family, for my family, and for the families of this nation?
Well, I'm very interested. I want us to have the basic rights that, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, that's really, you know, what I'm fighting for, and what I'm fighting for your family and my family, and really every single family. And so that's the base, the baseline. And, you know, I have to say, you know, we're the question of our, you know, for, you know, physical violence, you know, the kind of the rhetoric that of a kind of Christian nationalism, the rhetoric of like who really belongs, it doesn't fall on deaf ears. I mean, people hear that, and we know that they can respond with violence, and they do. And so, you know, synagogues under attack, the hate crimes against Jews, escalating. You know, the question of the whether my marriage will still be legal in the eyes of the Supreme Court is a very real one. And so, the more than ever, this is a time where Muslims and Jews and people of all different genders and sexualities, we have to come together and recognize that none of us none of our rights are just in an island over here. That it's very, very connected. And how do we come together across religious difference, recognizing that we're not coming with the same experience, but that we all have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that we have to stand up for one another. I want to say, like, you know, as just to make sure I do say it, because I admire it so much, what you did with when the Muslim ban was happening, you said, like, if they're going to start registering Muslims, then you're going to have to register me as a rabbi. I will be a Muslim, and or something to that effect. I'm not saying it exactly right, but
close enough.
But you know, you showed solidarity for another group that was under attack because because you're a decent human being, but you also recognize that your rights were tied up in their rights, and that none of us are going to do this alone. And that's the kind of leadership that I aspire to display as your successor and going forward, is really encouraging people of all faiths and no faiths to work together and stand up for one another, celebrating the diversity and just resisting and offering another future that is better to the American population.
Well, we'll have plenty more conversations, you and I, as the months and years go on, many of them on this channel, on State of Belief Radio, because you stand both by birthright and by upbringing at the intersection of some extraordinary streams of influence in American society. I look forward to exploring all of them with you, I hope one at a time. But I want to leave on a positive note, given that we've talked about so many problems. What gets you up in the morning? Where is the hope that inspires you, despite what we both acknowledge are the challenges facing our society?
All around us are amazing people. You know, I mean, it is incredible. Like, the people I meet all the time, like, I'll just give you, you know, obviously, like, I have young kids, so you know, they wake me up in the morning, literally. But then they go to a school, a public school in New York City, where the teachers are so committed and so give them everything. And then, you know, and then there's, you know, down the street, there's someone who has a small shop who, like, is you know, offers them a snack after, and I just feel like all around us are good people who we interact with, and we have to keep the humanity in front of us, because it's very hopeful. I'm also, like, really inspired by artists and by beauty and by this wonderful world we lived in. And so, you know, there's a book based on the What a Wonderful World, and both of my children can recite the lyrics to that song. And, you know, it talks about just all around us, the people of all the, you know, the colors of the rainbow in the sky are reflected on the faces of the people going by. And I really feel like it is a wonderful world, and yet it is our job to make sure that it truly is a wonderful world for all. And so those are the kinds of ruminations that I have on a daily basis.
That's great. The Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch is a writer, editor, and religious activist. He is currently serving as senior advisor at Interfaith America. Paul takes up the role of president and CEO of Interfaith Alliance in September, and will herald an exciting new era for the organization that has been a part of my life for most of my career. Paul, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. I look forward to many more conversations.
Before we go, I want to take a minute to remember a friend. Carrie Donley was mayor of Alexandria, Virginia for many years. Before and after his tenure as mayor, he was active in civic organizations for the benefit of all the residents of Alexandria. The mayor of Alexandria is a part-time position, and Carrie worked as a banker during that time because it afforded him the opportunity to devote himself to civic matters. But after he retired from politics, he became a teacher and a coach at the local high school, very much within the nature of his personality. The thing that impressed me most about Carrie Donley was that during the troubles in Northern Ireland, his very proud Irish family, his wife and five daughters, made it a point to invite a 10 or 11-year-old girl to spend a summer with them each year to bring them away from the troubles in Northern Ireland and to give them a sense that life could be better and peaceful. He was a man of deep faith, a member of the Blessed Sacrament Catholic community in Alexandria. And he brought those values to his life as an individual and as a public figure. Those are the kinds of people who serve our country best, those who bring the healing power of their faith to work for all of the residents of their communities. Rest in peace, Carrie Donley, suddenly gone at 66. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of this conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, go team. I'm Jack Moline. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.